Knoxville, Tennessee, was right proud of itself in April 1912, embracing with an enthusiasm all that the 20th century was bringing to it. Motor cars were suddenly in Knoxville, all over the place, scaring both pedestrians and horses. One report dating back to them noted how reckless drivers were running at from 20 to 40 miles per hour. As a consequence, the city passed a law that cars could not travel faster than 15 miles per hour within the city limits, or 10 miles per hour on downtown business streets. But police had difficulty enforcing that law. Officers then were issued with stopwatches to help them judge speeders. The city then was getting faster, more sophisticated as well. The theatres were in full swing, attracting talent such as the New York Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Walter Damrosch, with guest Jan Kubelich, the world's greatest violinist. Other places of entertainment were not just quite as upmarket. One that professed quality touted Dr. Volta, electrical wizard, therefore Volta. And he was running 3 shows daily for the entire week. So Knoxville was getting on its feet, a big city, and as far as any Knoxvillian was concerned, it was almost proud now to be able to face big city problems and issues. That Sunday, preachers across the city devoted sermons to raising awareness and money for a new tuberculosis sanatorium. That Monday morning's Journal and Tribune, the local paper, brought confusing news. On the front page, secondary now to the Republican primary dilemma and to news of another local flood in Louisiana, there was a headline, "Liner Titanic in Distress." Then on page 12, a late breaking bulletin, "Giant Liner Titanic is reported sinking." The next day brought the doomsday headline, "Giant Titanic sinks." And already they were estimating that more than 1,200 people had died. And on an inside page, a headline that sent a chill down the spine of those people living in Knoxville. The headline was this, "Reverend Bateman aboard Titanic." It didn't take much of a detective to work out that Reverend Bateman would be among the number of the dead. He had appeared in the passenger lists, and the journal explained, "It seems that but few of the male passengers were saved." On Central Street in Knoxville at that time, at the very foot of Cumberland Avenue, was a plain white cinder block church, sitting as a monument to this man who had been presumed lost on the famous White Star liner, the Titanic. And 550 miles away, south of Knoxville, in Jacksonville, in Florida, there was another community plunged into mourning over the very same event. Only one person from the state of Florida died aboard the liner when she sank, the Reverend Robert J. Bateman. But though he was the only one in the entire state, he was Jacksonville's most popular public figure. Dr. Bateman was the most useful man in Jacksonville. His death is a public calamity, one of the contemporary newspapers reported. Dr. Bateman is mentioned in the book and the film A Night to Remember, where in that film he leads some passengers in prayers and he conducts the band in playing Nearer, My God to Thee, his favourite hymn, as the great ship went down. Then the more recent Oscar-winning film, The Titanic, directed by James Cameron, has a similar scene, although the characters are not identified. But who was Dr. Robert James Bateman, and what is his story? I've advertised this message as God's ministers on board the Titanic. But that was a little bit presumptuous. To deal with them all, and therefore to engender confusion by throwing in three or maybe even four names, would defeat the purpose. Tonight, I will tell the story of only one of God's ministers on board the Titanic. Others may well follow. We've mentioned on Wednesday night, Scottish preacher John Harper, who died on the Titanic at 39 years of age, but was survived by his daughter, Nana. Reverend Ernest Carter and his wife from London. Mrs. Carter was the daughter of Thomas Hughes, author of Tom Brown's School Days. R. Charles Leonard Kirkland. A lot of people couldn't find any information about him, but he came from and ministered in Meehan. So tonight, Reverend Robert Bateman, who was an Englishman, but he made a lasting impression upon his adopted homes, the other side of the Atlantic, in Knoxville, Tennessee, and in Jacksonville, Florida, and also in a place we haven't yet mentioned, Baltimore, in Maryland, where he served as a minister, an evangelist, and a champion of the disadvantaged. That's why we read and emphasized Acts 10, the verse 38, our Lord Jesus Christ, who went about doing good. This is Bateman's story. Consider, first of all, his life and ministry. His life and ministry. He was born in Bristol, in England, on the 14th of October, 1816, ordained to the gospel ministry when he was 21 years of age, and serves as a pastor and an evangelist in Wales, in England, and also in Ireland, according to an article written by the Jacksonville historian Edward A. Mueller. After he had earned a medical degree in London, as a Christian physician, he became interested in urban rescue work. He then moved over to the United States and he worked, along with his father, for a short time as a stonemason before branching out into the ministry in Baltimore. He was superintendent for a while of the Florence Crittenden Mission in Baltimore. In his evangelistic work there, among the dying and outs principally, he used a presentation with a rather innovative magic lantern that was a gas-burning slideshow forerunner of the later motion picture films. There'd be something like a forerunner of our overhead projectors, and so on. And his forte was a presentation that he called the Passion Play. It brought the cross of Jesus Christ to the minds of those to whom he was preaching, and he emphasized to those dying and outs the love of God for fallen sinners. In 1901, Bateman conducted a service in Baltimore in which at the end of the meeting only three boys came forward to receive Christ. Disappointing, he thought. Yet one of those boys that night was E. Stanley Jones, who went on to become one of America's most famous, most effective Methodist missionaries and author of many books about Christ in India. When he came to write his autobiography, A Song of Ascents, Stanley Jones describes Bateman, under whose ministry he came to Christ. through his rough exterior, I saw there was reality within. He was a converted alcoholic, on fire with God's love, and I said to myself, I want what he has. I accepted him for what he was, a devoted diamond in the rough, winner of souls. In the late 1890s, Robert Bateman moved to Knoxville in Tennessee, and he founded there the non-denominational People's Tabernacle. He had been in Knoxville, Tennessee, when, round about 6 or so years before that, in fact, 16 years before that, when he was a young man in the 1880s, preaching in the slums from the back of a wagon. There were a lot of well-heeled Knoxvillians who were becoming rather anxious about the city's growing reputation for vice. And so in 1896, streetcar magnate C.C. Howell and others sent out a message to Bateman and persuaded him to come to their city, to Knoxville, and open a mission in the middle of the city's most dangerous quarter, South Central Street, known as the Bowbury. It was that part of town that the affluent, part of them at least, wanted to wipe off the map. Or the most idealistic among them, well, we'll try and save it. Bateman opened the People's Tabernacle mission at the corner. We've already described the church in an introduction down at the corner of two streets, Central and East Cumberland. And he supplied food and shelter and clothing and strong advice to the poor. And he set up within spitting distance of whorehouses and gambling saloons where murder was more regular than charity. Bateman apparently had a bit of a stocky frame, had a moustache. In the American mind, they thought as he looked at him that he resembles our President Roosevelt. But he was admired at both ends of the social slope. By 1902, he had left town to establish other missions in other places. He had to leave behind him as he left Knoxville his grown daughter Daisy, who had fallen for the Knoxville pharmacist John Walker. While he moved back to Knoxville for a few months only in 1907, eventually he travels that 550 miles down through into Florida to Jacksonville, and he started up, as was his wont, another mission station. Our Lord talks about not fearing them who kill the body. After that, there is no more that they can do. Matthew 10 and verse 28. But he says, fear him who can put both body and soul into hell. Bateman gets to work in Jacksonville, Florida, and he finds plenty of destitute and downtrodden people in there during the first decade of the 20th century. It was a major rail terminus, and also a wide open port. So Jacksonville was attracting here the broken dregs of humanity, as well as citizens of Greek prosperity. Mobs of sailors you would have seen had you gone down Jacksonville streets at that time, and they would have been mingling with railroad workers, turpentine men, hobos, bankers and tourists, in front of a lavish set of resort hotels. The city's reputation as a health resort lured tuberculosis patients from all over the country of the USA, but many of them found that by the time they had got their way to Jacksonville in Florida, they had used up all of their money and often had to sleep then within the streets. Shanty towns surrounded the core of Jacksonville. Vice of every description flourished in the place. Dusty barns and makeshift areas. Crowds of sweating men were gambling away their pay on prize fights, rat fights, cock fights, dog fights, and even contests between dogs and a chained bear. Crowds were pressing to the windows of stores in the tattoo parlors to watch the artists and blazing sailors with dragons and eagles and skulls and all manner of licentious pictures as well. Liquor flowed so freely. The temperance crusader Carrie Nation raided Jacksonville's Falstaff Saloon in 1908 and rows of open brothels lined the streets of La Villa, the section of the town known as Jacksonville Tenderloin. A few women were working in them by choice. Others were there because of the lack of education and economical circumstances forced them in there. Some women reportedly had been kidnapped and sold as slaves to those brothels. There's nothing new under the sun. And it was this place, this area, the worst in town, La Villa, in which Dr. Bateman chose, here's where I'm going to work. This is where I'm setting up my mission station. He established there for the Central City Mission in 1904 to combat poverty, to tackle evil, and to preach Christ right in the very heart of La Villa. Bateman himself wrote a poem about La Villa. It read like this: foul tenderloin, least wholesome spot in town, where vice and greed full many a man brings down. Vile hovels of licentiousness and glees, haunts of base youth, from whom virtue flees. How many hide behind your gaudy screen, where hollow happiness befouls each scene? The dancers there, filled from the foaming cup, attempting each to hold the other up. These are your charms, dank section. Spots like these that on the morning after feel to please. And he tried to care in that place for the people that nobody else cared about. How reflective is that of his Master and Savior? Who when in Matthew chapter 9, for example, 10, 11, went to teach and preach and then into the homes. And a whole outcry was caused because the Pharisees come along and he say, look at this. This is preposterous. It's ridiculous. Jesus, sitting with publicans, associating with sinners. The object of this work, he wrote, is to visit the sick, visit the jail, visit the workhouse, feed the poor, clothe the needy, hold nightly meetings, provide a home for fallen girls, an employment bureau, free reading room, visit the hospitals, the distribution of religious literature, encourage temperance, help restore lost relatives, and send the wanderer home. To do all of this, Robert Bateman built the mission building himself. And one day as he worked in the hot sun and he was laying the bricks for this structure, somebody asked him, could a preacher like you not find a softer job in a nicer section of town? I had rather have my mission than the best church in America, was his response. One monthly report makes interesting reading. It shows what Bateman was doing with his mission. Served in that month 1,284 meals to hungry people. Took in 836 homeless men for the night. Found jobs for 182 men. Sent food baskets to 12 families. Helped 5 wayward girls escape the brothels. Found homes for 4 orphan boys. Took care of 3 babies which desperate mothers had abandoned on the steps of the mission hall. Daily he made sure that those who were in need at hearty meals heard a soul-saving sermon. His popularity grew, and very soon he was invited into the inner circles there in Jacksonville, and he was asked, provide us as well, not just the downcast and the downtrodden, but us, the pillars of this society, provide us with spiritual direction. So while Beatman was working, on the one hand, with the most destitute members of the society there in Jacksonville, he was also mingling with the highest social elements of the city and the nation. In 1908, Jacksonville's mayor appointed Bateman to attend the National Conference of Charities in Richmond, Virginia. Then he had an invitation right from the president himself. Theodore Roosevelt invited Bateman to the White House to discuss the work that he was doing. Bateman all the while is assaulting Jacksonville's problems with sin and poverty and vice and drunkenness, and he does so in several ways which were looked upon as novel and innovative for that day. In 1 Corinthians 9:22, Paul the Apostle said, "By all means, I'm pulling those in that I might save some." Bateman worked with the Broad Street Merchants Association, the forerunner of their Chamber of Commerce, so that he might attract wholesome businesses and shoppers into this downtrodden region, La Villa. One of his efforts involved sponsoring a street carnival along with this Broad Street Merchants Association, and the carnival was set up in front of the Mission Hall. The promotion featured Paduano's Royal Italian Concert Band, Princess Olga, the daintiest, smallest woman in public life, Tompkins' Wild West Show, 10 human freaks, and one giant octopus. I wonder what would happen if we held out a banner on the side of the church advertising all of that today. Before long, just about everybody in Jacksonville, rich and poor alike, knew Dr. Bateman. One newspaper called him the man who distributes more human sunshine than any other in Jacksonville. Another said, if Jesus Christ had been in Jacksonville, he would have been seen often at the Central City Mission. Another newspaper said he went about doing good, an echo of Acts 10:38. He gathered in the sin-scarred brood, the poor, broken ones, penniless, homeless, helpless, hungering, and in rags. He housed the homeless, he fed the hungering, he clothed the naked, he helped the helpless to help themselves. A letter from a prostitute inspired him to do even more. "Dear Dr. Bateman, I hear you are going to start a home for us girls. I want to come to it. I can't do anything that is worth anything to anybody. I have tried to leave here, but nobody will give me work. This place is terrible, and I know lots of girls will come. For God's sake, do something quick." From a certain house on Davis Street, Bateman felt compelled to help that fallen girl, and others who similarly were fallen. And this was one of the main reasons, if not the key reason, why he went back to England for a short visit, and why he ended up on the Titanic on his way back to Jacksonville. His life and ministry. Secondly, his final journey. In February of 1912, Bateman returned to England for the first time since he'd left 23 years before, and primarily he was there to look about and explore and examine mission efforts. He travelled to his native Staple Hill in Bristol to visit his family, pay a visit to his mother's grave, and inspect a successful charitable centre, that's how it's described, similar to his mission back home now in Jacksonville. You might guess what the name of this charitable centre that Robert Bateman was so keen to get across and studying in Bristol really was. It was, of course, the orphanages on Ashley Down, built by George Mueller in Bristol, the place where Bateman had been born. This man, George Mueller, had established a home for over 3,000 orphans, and this orphanage, he heard, was functioning without any fundraising activity whatsoever, just operating by prayer. And Bateman wanted to organize a hospital and a home for fallen women as part of the work of the Central City Mission in Jacksonville. And he wanted to plan this work so that it would follow the pattern of the Bristol orphanages belonging to George Mueller. A newspaper called this trip a tour of investigation to the hotbeds of iniquity in England. Another reported, Dr. Bateman has been making a tour of study and observation in England for the purpose of familiarizing himself with the best methods of lifting fallen humanity. While he was in Bristol studying fallen humanity in the hotbeds, Dr. Bateman took several services in English churches. When he preached there in Bristol, he usually closed those services with his favorite hymn, Nearer, My God, to Thee. And the preaching of this old Wesleyan was so popular, so well received there, that on the day of his departure out of Bristol, a band playing this same hymn escorted him and Mrs. Ada E. Ball, his sister-in-law, who was going back to America. And that band came playing that hymn right to the train which took them down to the Titanic in Southampton. Crowds stood in front of the house. They cheered him when he came out. Great big men broke down and sobbed like little children when he said goodbye, Mrs. Ball, his sister-in-law, records. When they were purchasing their tickets to get across the Atlantic back to America, they were offered a special rate to return on the brand new RMS Titanic. It was an offer hard to ignore. And so, accompanied now by his sister-in-law, Ada Ball, he boarded the Titanic as a second-class passenger at Southampton on Wednesday, 10th of April, 1912, on ticket number 1166, paid the price of £12.10, 10d. Destination, Jacksonville, Florida, United States. Unknown to anyone else. Soon after that Titanic departed, they called in, as you know, in France, Southern Ireland, Cove. Reverend Bateman took two postcards from the cabin desk and penned them, one to his wife, one to his nephew. And he mailed the postcards when the Titanic retrieved supplies in France. According to the Belfast Telegraph newspaper of September 2007, one of Bateman's postcards was only one of two mailed that surfaced years after the Titanic sank. In 2007, Dr. Bateman's postcard was auctioned for €15,000. The Titanic left on Good Friday. As the passengers lined the decks, waved confidently, they knew they were on the world's largest and unsinkable passenger ship. That ship left the dock. And the pastor amused his sister-in-law, who was rather frightened of the water, by comparing features on the Titanic to features of Jacksonville around the Central City Mission that he ran. "I was always afraid of the water," she explains. "Robert was jolly and comforted me. We are going up Old Broad Street," he would say, as he walked with me in the decks. "That's the subway, and there's the viaduct in Jacksonville," he would say, pointing at the bridge. "I have never seen anyone more happy than Robert was. He sang to himself any time he was not preaching," Mrs. Ball said. And that brings us to his last night on this earth. His life and ministry, his final journey, finally his activity one step from eternity. His activity, one step from eternity. After she was rescued, Mrs. Ball told what had happened aboard the Titanic. On Sunday, 14th of April, 1912, she said, "Dr. Bateman, by invitation of the captain, conducted a religious service on the liner, 10:30 in the morning. He concluded that meeting by calling the passengers to turn to Christ. The closing hymn, quite predictably, was, 'Nearer, my God, to thee.'" One survivor said that Dr. Bateman was the most popular man on the Titanic. But that same night at 11:45, 11:40, an iceberg grazed the side of the Titanic. And that ice peeled a 300-foot strip from the steel hull. For some time we had been seeing icebergs of various sizes floating in the ocean. Despite this fact, the ship was running at a tremendous rate of speed, Mrs. Ball said. One passenger said the sound of the metal being stripped from the side of the ship sounded no louder than a piece of cloth being torn. But Mrs. Bates' roommate begged to differ and said, "It was a tremendous shock that made me think the boilers had blown up." Mrs. Ball was asleep when the ship struck. Her roommate woke her. I laughed at her and told her there was nothing wrong and went back to sleep, Mrs. Ball said. But her brother-in-law, Reverend Robert Bateman, soon pounded on the doors of the woman's cabin. There was no time to dress. Mrs. Ball ventured onto the boot deck in her nightgown and feeling the Arctic cold. She wanted to go down to the cabin again for warm clothes, but Bateman held her back, took off his overcoat, draped it around her shoulders. Mrs. Ball later told reporters, "The boat was at that time listed away over to starboard and sinking in front so that we could hardly walk. I will never forget Robert as he stood on the deck with me. 'The boat's slanting,' I told him." "Yes," he answered. "We have struck terribly hard." "Well," I said, "if there's any danger, I am ready." "Thank God, so am I," he said. The Titanic, as we reflected upon this morning, carried lifeboats sufficient for less than half of the number of people on board. Hundreds of people were milling around on the decks, not knowing where to go or what to do. And in the panic, Reverend Bateman became separated from his sister-in-law when he had thought that she had been placed in a lifeboat. He later found a seat in a lifeboat himself. He was ready to be towed away from the doomed vessel. When he looked back and saw his sister-in-law still on board, and he insisted on being allowed to exchange places with her. And as he gave up his seat and helped her into the boat, he gave his Bible to her. As far as is known, his is the only Bible saved from the Titanic. It's now in the library of Baxter Seminary in the U.S. It's not one I'd be bursting to read, apart from just interest value, because it was the emphatic diaglot. You've never heard of it, I'm sure, containing the original Greek text. So it wasn't in English, evidently, of the New Testament, with an interlinear word-for-word English translation based on the interlinear translation. That's not a translation that I would have much time for. But the point of it is, his Bible was clearly not far from his hand. When in all the commotion and giving out the help he did, when those passengers were running around in panic on the deck, he had been carrying still his Bible with him. Might have been one of the first things, or the only thing, he decided worth taking. His sister-in-law claimed that she was one of the last passengers to abandon the ship and find a spot in a lifeboat. As her lifeboat was lowered into the water, Speedman escorted her and other women to one of the boats. He said to her, "Don't be nervous, Annie. This will test our faith. I must stay and let the woman go. If we never meet again on this earth, we will meet again in heaven." As the boat lowered, Robert stepped up to the railing and threw me, she says, his silk handkerchief. "Put that around your throat," he said. "You'll catch cold." She comments, "Just imagine thinking of such a little thing in a time like that." Survivors, she says, were literally thrown from the top deck into the boats as they were being swung from the davits and lowered to the black water below. Confusion and turmoil ruled even in the lifeboat. "I found the baby," she says, "in my possession without the least idea whom it belonged to. I never did find out. Our boat had more children in it than any of the others her roommate had observed." After he had seen the woman and children as well safely off, as many as could be, escorted off that sinking ship, after the last lifeboat was taken and cast off, Reverend Bateman convinced several men to come along with him, help him to unlock some of the steerage passageway doors that kept the third class passengers below deck, just to give a chance to those unfortunate and ill-fated passengers, just a chance that they might somehow escape. Then, according to a passenger who did survive, must have fallen into the water, been picked up by a lifeboat of somewhere. Bateman collected about 50 men in the stern of the ship and told them that they should prepare for death. He led them in praying the Lord's Prayer. Mrs. Ball's lifeboat remained close to the Titanic. She believed that Bateman, as a final act, persuaded the band to play "Nearer My God to Thee" in the last moments of the Titanic. Before we had been in the boat very long, she notes, we saw the Titanic go down. The stars were bright. We could see the lights of the ship. The band was on the stern and went down playing. We could hear the screams of those on board. Cries of "Save us!" But of course we could do nothing. The bow of the ship filled with water. The stern rose higher and higher, till the Titanic was standing nearly perpendicular to the icy Atlantic. The lights of the ship remained on, even in the bow already submerged, giving a kind of rosy submarine glow. Those in the lifeboats, like Mrs. Ball, could see men clinging to handholds, like clusters of bees on a tree. Then the ship slid under. The ship struck head on and appeared to collapse in half just before it went down, Mrs. Ball said. When she sank, there was silence. A moment later, the cries and supplications of 1,500 dying men rose in melancholy chorus over the spot where she went down. Those men are struggling now in the freezing water. It was heart-rending, piteous, to hear the awful cries and moans just as the ship was sinking. Lights remained until within 3 or 4 minutes before the ship sank, gradually disappeared from view as the ship went down and left a black space and shadow of a huge iceberg. She said, "I saw one of the lifeboats with 30 or 40 tip over as it was being lowered, and all were thrown into the water to dry. Many swam in different directions. We could only see those nearest our boat. I saw at least 200 bodies in the water." She also saw another man in another boat, shouting at people swimming towards the boat, looking for a space to keep away. We're fooled if you get on board. We're all in the water. Colonel Archibald Gracie later told what it was like to be in the water. Again and again, he said, I prayed for deliverance, although I felt sure the end had come. I reached the surface after a time that seemed unending. There was nothing in sight. Sea of the ice and a large field of wreckage. There were dying men and women all around me. One of the Titanic's funnels separated, fell apart near me, scattering the bodies in the water. A great crate-like block of wood floated within my grasp, and I grabbed it, he said. Lieutenant Gracie, or Colonel Gracie, eventually found a lifeboat that was floating upside down in the water. And he joined 20 men standing on the upturned bottom of the boat. Presently the raft, as he described it, became so full that it seemed she would sink if more came aboard, and the crew, for self-preservation, had to refuse to permit others to climb aboard. This was at once the most pathetic and the most horrible scene of all, the piteous cries of those around us still ring in my ears. Through all that wild night, there was not a moment that our prayers did not arise above the waters. Men who seemed to have forgotten long ago how to address their Creator recalled prayers of their childhood and murmured them. We said the Lord's Prayer again and again together. Gracie says, and so we passed the night with the waves washing over us, the raft buried deep in the water under our feet. We stood in columns, footing back to back, balancing ourselves, fearful to move, lest a delicate balance should be disturbed and all of us thrown into the water. We were standing in content to stand and pray. The slipping of one man would have meant the death, probably, of us all. Now the woman in the lifeboats didn't fare much better. Mrs. Ball and her companions spent 7 hours in the lifeboat. It had sprung a plank when it hit the water, and they bailed all night to keep themselves from being swamped. The first rescue ship, and we heard of it this morning, Carpathia, arrived at dawn. Only just over 700 survivors were gathered out of 2,200 plus. Some men had fought for a lifeboat, looking for a place. Reverend Robert Beekman had died to give room to others. After treatment at Sydenham Hospital in New York, Mrs. Ball came to Jacksonville to stay with her sister, Mrs. Bateman. Memorial services were held in the Knoxville People's Tabernacle the next Sunday. They brought in a male quartet. They sang Bateman's favorite hymns, including Nearer My God to Thee. Several days later, and 12 days after the tragedy, cable ship Mackay Bennett found Bateman's body floating face down in the Atlantic Ocean. He was identified by his jewelry, including a gold watch and chain and gold cufflinks, and by the contents in his pockets and in his watch case. He opened it up. He found a photograph of George Mueller, whose orphanage plan he intended to implement when he got back to Jacksonville. According to the archives, he was the 174th deceased passenger whom they recovered. That number was stamped on a badge attached to his tomb. Took his body to Nova Scotia because he'd been so popular. Telegrams were received up there saying, we want his body returned to Baltimore. We want it returned to Memphis. Ship it to us. Mrs. Bateman, his wife, had to appeal to a federal district court judge and to the mayor of Jacksonville before she could have her husband's body shipped home for burial in Jacksonville's Evergreen Cemetery. And finally, on the 6th of May, 1912, his body left Nova Scotia on a steamer for the long journey down to Jacksonville. 130 coffins were on board that steamer, including Bateman's, two chaplains, one undertaker, and apparently a large quantity of ice. Before burial, they held a memorial service for Reverend Bateman in Jacksonville's First Baptist Church. 11 ministers presided. It was like a hero-style funeral, the largest in Jacksonville's history up to that time. Mourners, some in rags, some in the best-dressed refinery. They lined the route of the funeral procession. Rich and poor hugged each other and wept. The minister delivering the eulogy said, "I somehow felt from the first that Dr. Bateman would be among the lost. Knowing Dr. Bateman as I knew him, I believed he would do just what he did in a crisis like that. Help others to safety, take his chances among the last." How beautifully characteristic of the man who was so like him. He died as he lived, serving others with a triumphant faith in God. Just a plain slab marks his final resting place in that evergreen cemetery, but 100 yards away or so, a single lonely cenotaph contains the words, "Dr. R.J. Bateman, born October the 14th, 1860, died April the 15th, 1912. He lost his life in the wreck of the Titanic." Eerily, I suppose, following the disaster, his widow and nephew received their postcards. They were postmarked Cherbourg, France. He had written to his wife, "I feel that my trip has not been in vain. God has singularly blessed me. We had a glorious revival. It was the time of my life." Preaching, as he had in Bristol, he had seen souls won again for Christ. His nephew received another postcard mailed at the same time. "Tom, if this ship goes to the bottom, I shall not be there. I shall be up yonder. Think of it." Bateman had ridden. When his wife and nephew later prized open Bateman's locked roll-top desk, they discovered that he had set his affairs in order, that he had written a poem on a black-bordered card, left the poem on top of the other papers. It was as though he expected not to return. And that card left in Jacksonville before he went over to Bristol read like this. Do you shudder as you picture all the horrors of that hour? But Jesus was beside me to sustain me by his power. And he came himself to meet me in that way so hard to tread, and with Jesus' arm to cling to. Could I have one doubt or dread? How about that for a poem written before this event, over the course of many weeks? With Jesus' arm to cling to, could I have one doubt or dread? In closing, let me throw out the challenge. Who can tell when your life will be taken? Who can tell what's around the corner? Have you made preparation for heaven? Are you right with God? Have you responded favorably to his gospel? The Bible that Bateman carried charts your way, shows you the path, leads you to Christ. And this preacher, this rough diamond of a preacher, who preached for perishing souls all through his life after conversion, he would lead you to Christ. And as Bateman was himself, the substitute moved out from the place of safety so that his sister-in-law might occupy his spot on the lifeboat, and he put himself in the area where he knew now he would definitely die. He would lead you to Christ, the ultimate substitute, who gave his life and died.